This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Cliff Misson was in and out of foster care throughout his childhood, never spent more than 2 years in the same school. Nevertheless, on the day he turned 18, he made a pledge to serve the poor for the rest of his life. Now, Chris will tell you that this tough childhood allowed him to recognize the good that even people with limited means can do. Cliff delivered on that promise when he traveled to West Africa to work with villagers on ways to drill their own water wells. And then he created the Wider Net Project, a nonprofit that brings access to digital information to places that have only limited connectivity, from Nepalese medical schools to government offices in Zambia and prisons in Texas. Cliff is now a professor at the University of North Carolina in the School of Information Library Science, and he joins me now on the State of Things. Cliff Misson, welcome. Good to have you here.
Pleasure to be here, Frank.
Tell us more about growing up. You grew up in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, right?
Mm-hmm. Beautiful Pacific Northwest. Wasn't exactly a beautiful childhood, but it had its complications. I think I lived in, before I turned 18, I lived in 11 different family situations. Some of them were relatives, some of them were foster homes, but just kind of bouncing around. I didn't know my mom, really, until I was about 14 years old. She had been institutionalized, and we'd been separated. So it was a rough childhood.
What was it like for you in and out of schools? Were you doing well in school?
When I was attending, and almost every school I attended, it was rough. But I always made a connection with the teacher, and that's the theme of my childhood has always been. There's always been an angel in every situation I've been in, where somebody just reached out, touched, and said, "Hey."
Keep it going. So, because also, in that situation, you can start with some behavior and acting out that can put you in on a path that you didn't really choose, but it's hard to come back from. Were you on that path?
I got into my share of trouble, but I also I had people around me who encouraged me to think differently. And, I was a very imaginative child, so I had lots of stories to tell myself and a lot of ways to entertain myself, and I entertained those around me, too.
What were some of those stories you were telling yourself? It's a tough one to have to rearrange things. I mean, I would imagine if you didn't know your mother and you knew about her but you couldn't make contact, what kind of stories do you tell yourself?
Well, I had a phase where I was really into superheroes, comic book superheroes. And, I just sort of, I had this really weird experience once where my aunts showed up at, I was going to a Catholic school, and one of the nuns came out to the playground and grabbed me by the hand and said, "Somebody's here to see you." And we walked to the front of the school, and there was one of these old 1950s cars with big round bumpers and all that. And it was full of these four mustachioed old women who just took me in and started hugging me. And to me, this is like, wow, this is like something from outer space. It turns out it was my aunts had picked up my mother and brought her by the school to see me and made an agreement with the nuns that I could spend some time with her.
What was that day like for you?
It was bizarre. Yeah. It was like I got picked up by Martians, and they fed me candy, and they took me to the zoo. And then at the end of the day, they dropped me off. And I'm sitting there going, woo, right? My head was just spinning with stories. Yeah. And it almost seemed like something out of a comic book.
I mean, is that something that you found yourself working into a story, or is that in its own little universe?
I cherish that story.
Yeah. But it's not something. Well, so you ended up homesteading in Alaska for a time. Tell us how that happened.
Yeah, so I had an aunt and uncle who were going up to Alaska, and they were going to be clearing land and building their own home, and they needed cheap child labor, and I was available. And they were a very loving couple, so it was a good situation for me to be in. They had a son my same age, so that was nice. And we grabbed chainsaws and cut down trees and cleared land, and for a 13, 14 year old boy, what could be more exciting.
I guess. I mean, you get a sense of yourself and kind of what you can do, right? A kind of a self-reliance. If you're cutting down trees, I'm thinking you're feeling like you can do a lot of stuff.
You know, in Fairbanks, they would not cancel school until it was 50 below zero. So at 48 below zero, I was out there in my cross-country skis going a half a mile to the road to park my skis and wait for the school bus.
So, wow.
Yeah, that's cool.
You've got the best 50 miles in a snowstorm story of anybody I know. I mean, it's actually true.
Yeah.
Uphill both ways. Right. You talked about so how long were you there in Fairbanks?
I was there for a couple of years.
Yeah. And again, you're 14, 15 years old. You talked about your mother. You've described your mother as sweet and wise, but she did have a dark side.
Well, my mother was bipolar.
Yeah.
And so she was a musician, played for the Seattle Symphony for 25 years, and then wound up being institutionalized. She was always sweet.
Yeah.
I think of her as the glue that kind of held. She had two marriages, and then my father had two marriages, and she was kind of the glue that kind of kept us as kids together.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
At some point, you found that you had to challenge you. There was a confrontation with your mother.
Not with my mother, but with another a stepmother who was you know, there were some situations I got into where alcohol and abuse were pretty rife.
And this was in a foster situation.
This was actually with my family, a family situation, but with my stepmother. So pretty rough, and I have, you know, scars to show for it. And, you know, sort of the scars, the physical scars are not nearly as long-lasting as the emotional scars.
Yeah.
Because here was somebody who was, frankly, homicidal. And she had no problems on a good day saying her intent was to kill me. Hmm. So that...
How did you deal with that?
For the most part, it's, you know, one learns to lay low.
Yeah,
I remember my brother and I during the summer, we would just get up at 6:30 in the morning and disappear and not come home till my father returned from work, because when he was home, we were safe.
I see.
Yeah. So just took a lot of survival stuff.
Was some of that I understand, too, that you found a refuge in places like libraries where you could kind of hide out. And
definitely. Yeah, and I, for some reason, nobody ever thought to look for me in a library. So it was a perfect place to hide out. And, you know, not just hide out physically in the library, but also, intellectually. I could go and get buried in a book and buried in a story, and it would help me forget my woes.
Did you find yourself gravitating to one particular kind of literature or another? Did you bounce around?
I definitely bounced around. Yeah. So, in fact, I was bounced out of some adult sections in the library.
I see. Well, there's that.
Yeah.
So you make this pledge. Tell us about this promise that you made at the age of 18 to help people who are less fortunate than yourself. Where were you, and why did you? What was going through your mind?
Well, at the age of 18, I dropped out of high school, and I was pretty strong-willed. It wasn't my best decision ever. I had been living for the last 8 months with a foster family, and I was strongly against the idea of somebody sort of supporting me and taking care of me. Felt I could take care of myself. Mm-hmm. I worked at a truck stop during high school, so I actually worked 40 hours a week and went to school. And I was saving up money so I could be independent. But at the same time, I looked around at, you know, the Chinese have this saying about crisis and opportunity being two sides of the same coin. I had a rough childhood, but it seems at every corner, right, the other side of this was somebody who showed compassion and concern and caring. And when I think about all these families that took me in, they disrupted their lives to allow in a stranger. And I, you know, when I followed up with my foster families, you know, when I became an adult, my first question was, why would you do something like that? Right. So I realized that I had been given lots of gifts. and that there must be a reason for this. And so I wrote down a little note to myself. I may look like a failure right now. I just dropped out of high school. I've got nothing. I've got no visible means of support. Nothing going for me, but I'm going to succeed and I'm going to help people.
What did you do next? You dropped out of school, as you say, not a good way to support yourself. What was your next move?
Well, you know, the universe is full of magical things. I got a job at a group home for kids with mental disabilities. And it's 25 kids out in a big old ranch house out in the middle of nowhere in Ellensburg, Washington. And that year and a half with those kids was so curative for me because I got to help them, you know, every day. I got to experience people who were going through problems that I had never imagined, and the love. I mean, I don't think there's any being as loving as a Down syndrome person. Mm-hmm. And it was all there in one big package. And at the end of the year, I just felt my heart was open, and a lot of things had been released.
Cliff Misson is my guest. Cliff is a professor in the School of Information and Library Science at UNC, and we'll continue our conversation with him just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking with Cliff Misson, a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science, founded two nonprofits, one that brings well drilling technology, the other access to digital information for millions of people around the world. We'll talk about how you got there. We left you as a high school dropout with a very large goal, a very large plan of helping other people, and you spent a year and a half at a group home for people with mental disabilities. What happened after that?
I went to university. And nobody expected this. I didn't. In fact, when I was up in Alaska, I got put into a welding class for a year because it was assumed this kid is not going to university. But I found myself, again, you know, the universe is full of magical things. Somebody out there very lovingly put together a program and said, you know, there are some people who are so poor. They're bright, but they're poor, and they're never going to go to university. They made a program to get what they called economically disadvantaged students into the university. I wrote an essay. I got accepted. And, you know, I was a kid in a candy store. I would go to my classes at the University of Washington with the catalog. And at the end of the class, when all the other students were backing up to get out of there, I was going through the catalog to see what other lectures I could attend today. Right.
Oh, wow.
And I would go sit in on other people's lectures. I just loved it. I just loved being at the university.
And did well?
Did reasonably well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what were you planning on doing then? What would you major?
It changed every week, depending on which lecture I just heard.
And there were lots of them, as we just heard. Yeah.
Right. Right. But at one point, I was working out. I did an internship out in Washington, D.C. And it was a barely paid internship, so I was living in a sort of a shared situation. Mm-hmm. And I met some Africans who were going to school in D.C., and their lifestyle and their behaviors and their excitement and zeal were just so unusual to me. And I would ask them, you know, where do you guys come from? Where does this, you know, where do you get this energy? And they say, man, you just have to go to Africa. So I was looking for a way. I wanted to go to Africa, but I didn't want to go as a tourist. And I found this organization called Operations Crossroads Africa. You raise your own money, and then you could join a team, and you go, and you spend 3 months. And so that's what I did. And I said, I'd like to be in a rural place because I was used to living in rural communities. So they found this task, which involved in Liberia, going out to a rural village that was 5 hours away from the nearest road. Literally, we had to, you know, those old movies where they have the guy hiking through the woods and there's people with machetes cutting down. That was me, because I was the tallest person to ever walk down that trail.
You go first. Here, take this.
Yeah. And we set up a clinic out in this very rural village. And the whole time I was there, and this is for me, much of development, much of good development and good caring and love is about listening. And what I was seeing at the clinic was a lack of water, or poor quality water was causing the bulk of the diseases we were treating. And the village had no well. So I started agitating, hey, you guys, we can dig a well, because I had helped dig a well in Alaska. And the villagers were, sure, they'd say. But in that way, that meant no way.
Right.
Because they couldn't say no directly.
Right.
It would be inappropriate. So in the end, I found out that the Crew people, KRU, they believe in evil spirits that inhabit the earth. And the last thing they wanted to do was climb down into a deep hole in the ground and meet an evil spirit. And so then I was, okay, well, how do we drill a hole? Because we've been drilling wells for centuries now. So I came back to the U.S. with that challenge, how to drill a hole in a village where the most common tool is a machete. And that's
and not disturb the spirits. And you found a technology that was pretty old and might work.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. And this is actually a great an apt analogy too. You know, information can move very quickly and can change people's lives very dramatically.
Right.
The Chinese have been drilling deep wells since 1100 BC. The Europeans were swimming in their own filth for 1,000 of those years. Okay. It took Marco Polo's people going off to China and learning how to drill these deep wells and taking that technology back to Europe before the first deep wells were drilled in Paris and London. Thomas Jefferson drilled a well using this old Chinese method. All right. So we hit the history books at Evergreen State College, where I was going to college at the time, and we just built a bunch of old rigs straight out of the history books and played with them and realized this old Chinese method was the most effective way.
Yeah, but how do you get around the evil spirits problem? You're still making a hole in the earth and disturbing the spirits, right?
But you're making a little 6-inch hole and you're standing on the surface.
So you're not having to dig the well. You don't have to go inside.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So the Chinese were drilling like 1,000 feet.
Right.
So there's no way you can climb down in there, but this is all done from the surface. And it's a very simple little apparatus. Well, once you see it in action, it's a simple apparatus. But until you see it in action, it sounds like magic. But for $250, I can go into any country and take some scrap steel and make a well drill. So
tell us about your experience going back and then offering to work with folks on developing this technology or using this technology.
Yeah. So I founded a nonprofit called Wellspring Africa at wellspringafrica.org. And we raised money to go back and spend a year in the village, training people from the surrounding villages how to drill water wells. And it was a marvelous year. Out in the middle of nowhere.
Wait, and I want to point this out. I mean, I'm going to take you back to Washington D.C., a very expensive city for somebody with not much money, and this is part of the problem with internships in a place like D.C. There's plenty of opportunity, but only rich kids can afford to have an internship because who else can squat on the property in DuPont Circle and work for free? And so it's very difficult to bring people in who haven't had that. But so now you're in a group house. I can only imagine barely making it in D.C., and you decide to raise money to take you someplace else. You decide to raise money not for yourself, but to go to Africa, and then do it again to create a nonprofit. So this is the second time in which you have yet to move yourself into the 1%. But you're working on – tell us about the experience of creating a nonprofit. I mean, because that takes a lot of skill and knowledge too. You probably had to look that up. How do I do this?
Yeah. Well, yeah. They're libraries. So I went to libraries and I read books and I talked to people who had founded nonprofits and got some good ideas from them. Although I'll tell you, when I founded Wellspring Africa, I went to give a presentation to a group of church women at a Methodist church, and they listened to my 10-minute presentation and they said, wonderful. And they wrote me a check right there for $500 and then said, okay, we're going to carry on our meeting. You may leave. So I walked outside the room and I stood there for 15 minutes thinking I should go back in there and give them this check back because this means I really have to do this.
Meanwhile, you've written a manual on drilling and apparently it gets quite a few downloads.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that's how most of my master's degree was around learning how to communicate do development, and wrote this manual on water well drilling, made a video, for a while I was just, you know, people would send me $10 in the mail, and I would send it, you know, box it up and send it to them. And now, thanks to the web, it's up on my website, and it's getting down, you know, thousands of downloads every year.
To what extent was it important for you or for this project to succeed to develop relationships with people in those so that you could build trust? Because, again, you know, there's a risk to a very important cultural norm here, and mm-hmm. one way or another that provides a risk. What was it like to build trust so that you could get to the point where you could use this technology?
I think I said, like I said before, half of good development is simply listening, mm-hmm. and just being there, showing up. That's really critical. When I was teaching my well drilling course in the village, there were I think 15 or 16 people in the class, but one person had appointed himself the class president. And virtually every day for the first several weeks, he would show up at the beginning of class and then raise his hand and get up and respectfully ask why. You know, he wanted to figure out why we were there. And so he would say, well, maybe you're in trouble with the authorities at home and you're hiding out here. And I'd say, no. And, oh, dang, he'd say. And the next day, well, maybe you're trying this technology here, and if it works, you'll take it back to America and you'll make some money off of it. And then I'd explain to him why that wasn't a good idea, you know, thing. And he kept trying to figure out why we're there. And the villagers are always very appreciative of us just being there. And that to me is the most important thing, showing up and listening.
Right. Yeah. And then to what extent is it now possible for people in those areas now to pass on that so that they become the apostles of this technology? Does that happen or has it happened with this?
That has happened, but it happens too infrequently.
Mm.
And that has, you know, as I grow into working in this field, I see it's much more important to work with people to become water entrepreneurs rather than just drillers.
Mm-hmm.
To show them the whole, how do you plan, how do you finance, how do you maintain a business over time, right? And that's kind of the area I'm focusing on now.
And does that work? I mean, again, you think about some of the lack of economic opportunity, and I may be wrong about that, but that if you're trying to sort of develop it as a business, is that viable in some of these places?
It is. A few years ago, I was in Niger training some drillers, some water well diggers there, training them how to do some drilling. And the head of this group had been doing digging water wells for 15 years. And he had about 20 people working for him who were going around to these small farmers, and they were digging wells for agricultural use.
Mm.
And I asked him, I said, well, you know, what would it take for you to increase your production? And he was very clear. He said, I need a truck, because I'm spending all my time negotiating, getting people and tools from one place to another on other people's vehicles. If I had a truck, I could quadruple my output. Right. And so there, you know, very clearly he needed some investment.
Right.
Yeah.
And once you do that, then a lot of it then becomes local reinvestment, where people are getting paid and now they're sort of able to develop a small local economy.
Exactly.
So tell us about this. So you've got the well operation going, and then you were teaching information technology, and you returned to Africa on a Fulbright scholarship, right?
Right. I'd spent a couple of years, well, 4 years, teaching about information technology in developing countries, and that was my research area. And of course, this is back in the mid '80s, early '90s. Oh no, mid '90s. Sorry.
Right.
And where I was working with technology and teaching with technology at the University of Iowa every day, there really wasn't a lot happening in sub-Saharan Africa with technology. So I was awarded a Fulbright. And I went to the University of Jos in central Nigeria. And from there, I went out and visited half a dozen other major universities and interviewed people. And there wasn't a lot of strategic thinking happening at the time. And a number of people said the same thing. They said, you know, the only people who come to talk to us are people who have something to sell. So it's not like they were getting good information or a wide array of options. There was somebody showing up with some thing that right. they wanted them to purchase. And they had to, without a lot of information, make a call about whether that was worth it to them. I visited one university that had just spent $25,000 clearing a donated computer from a European oil company. And it had been shipped to them. They had to pay for the shipping. They had to clear it through the ports and then transport it up to their university. And when we went to see it, my heart just fell because it was an old mainframe computer that I could have picked up at Goodwill for $100 for scrap. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the main components of this computer had been taken out, the expensive parts.
And so it wasn't even going to work.
It was never going to work.
Wow.
And they just spent their money on nothing.
Right. And that was, as you say, even though it was a donation, it still cost them $25,000 to get it there.
Right. Right. So that's when I realized my friends and colleagues needed sort of a friend in the business, right? Somebody who understood the technology, who could get them trained up on how to make these kinds of decisions and understand. Most people here, Frank, they don't understand the cost of computer systems. You know, we're sitting in a control room with all these computers and electronics around us, and we just use them. And right. we say, oh, that was easy. We pay $50 a month for our internet and say, okay, that was right. simple. But it's really, really expensive. And it doesn't get any cheaper in developing countries because they don't make this technology. Right. They have to buy it, and they have to buy it on the market, and it costs them more than it costs us. And so it's just a really expensive undertaking. The typical American university spends $2,000 per student per year on information technology alone.
Wow.
Now, I visited a university in India that was trying to offer a four-year degree for $750. That's everything.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah. So you start to do the math. And again, if you think about it, even in the 90s, I mean, the technology is changing so quickly. So there were probably a lot of programs that would ship even desktop computers. But now what? You get it. And if there's a single problem with that computer, again, if you don't have the parts and the expertise to fix that thing,
mm-hmm.
it goes yeah. broken pretty fast. And now you've got not a desktop, but a paperweight.
Right. So we have shipped 1,600 computers to our colleagues, but they don't just get a cargo container full of computers. They get lots of spare parts, and we show up and we do training. And I did a training in Ethiopia a few years back where the official people had decided that like six people needed to get trained that they selected. And I said, I was hoping for 60. And so they ginned up some more people, but not 60. And I finally said, well, why don't we just hit up the high school? And so they sent a letter around to three different high schools in the town and said, send us your 10 best students. And out of the 30 students that showed up, 20 of them were girls. And we had the best time. We just took computers, but everyone took a computer part, put it back together again, installed the software, did cut network wires. And we just spent the week working with technology. We blew up a few power supplies because they're power supply is different than ours, mm-hmm. but we had fun doing it.
So it's one thing to get your computers up and working, but then what's on them? Information technology, getting access to the information. Tell us mm-hmm. about that, because that's the big and most difficult connection to make, particularly
right.
these days
right.
with high-speed connections and the rest of us taking all of this for granted.
Right. So when I went to do my Fulbright at the University of Joss, we had a network. I took 36 boxes of computers on the plane with me. You should have seen the look when we went to check in.
Sure, that will not fit in the overhead. I'm sorry. You have to check that.
Exactly. Yeah. But so we had a server, we had networking, we had all these computers, but I didn't have the internet. And at that point, the university had a phone dial-up that worked once or twice a week for maybe an hour. And I was really frustrated because I had become dependent on lots of resources from the internet. So I wrote home to my graduate assistant and I asked her, would you just copy a couple of websites that I need onto a CD-ROM and send them to me? Well, she was thoughtful enough to go out and copy a bunch of websites onto a number of DVDs and send them to me. We copied that to the server, and the next day we had our first case of internet addiction. A young student who wasn't going to classes, who didn't stop to eat food. He just wanted to be there
yeah.
and move through this material. Yeah.
Because you downloaded the content from all these websites. I mean, these aren't just web addresses that you're getting. Obviously, you don't have access.
Yeah.
And so, let's just get this stuff and put it on a hard drive and see what happens. So what happened? So there's one student. Did this become a virus? Did it spread?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and I was teaching from it every day using all this content. And today, 16 years later, one half of the IT staff at that university were people who went through my training program back in 2000. So they've taken those skills, and they, a couple of students have gotten PhDs in information technology since then.
I tell you what, we'll talk about where it went from there when my conversation with Cliff Misson continues. Cliff's a professor in the School of Information and Library Science at UNC, the founder of Wellspring Africa and the WiderNet Project, and we'll talk about all that on the state of things when our program returns. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Cliff Misson today, a professor in the School of Information and Library Science at UNC, founder of two nonprofits that brought well drilling technology as well as access to digital information to millions of people in the developing world. We're talking about teaching in Jos, Nigeria, when you were there and sort of getting an information technology or kind of program going. But you talked about you had one student who submitted a paper to you that at some point, you know, sort of opened your eyes to another reality. Right.
You know, because when we think, oh, somebody's not on the internet here, we think, well, they can go to the library or pick it up someplace else. There is no someplace else. So this young man brought me a paper. He said he would love me to look at this and give him my feedback. And that evening, I'm sitting with the paper. I'm looking at it, and this is a very well-rendered paper. Right, and the form and function, everything's there. He's talking about some very new technologies, and he's doing it in a rather positive tone. Right, he's loving these new technologies, but it's not very deep. Not getting very deep into these technologies, and so I read through the paper. I get to the end. I look at his sources, and all of his sources were from a single PC magazine. And as I sat there looking at it, I remembered. Weeks earlier, when I got off the plane and I arrived, I had a PC magazine I was reading on the plane. And I said, does anybody want this magazine? And this young man took this magazine and mined it and turned it into a paper. And I thought, boy, you know, if this brilliant young mind had access to a proper amount of information, he would set the world on fire. And that was, you know, when I was living in the villages in Liberia, it was the same thing. People just had too few ideas. I had a book called Where There Is No Doctor, and it's a very simple book for people in rural areas on how to take care of basic health things without a lot of tools. And there was a young woman who would come and spend the evenings with me just poring through that book. She couldn't take notes. She wasn't literate in that way, but she was just memorizing everything from the book. And she would come back the next day and she would give me tests from the book, right?
right.
So people are just dying. People are literally dying for lack of information. People are hungry for knowledge everywhere. And the more we can put in their hands and the broader that collection is, the more they can realize their fullest potential.
Right. Well, this brings us to the WiderNet project, does it not?
Right.
Tell us more about that.
So when I returned from my Fulbright year, I realized, there's a need for more training. There's a need for greater understanding. There's a need to focus on the needs of these particular universities, not trying to cookie cutter or push them into any kind of technology that has been successful here, but come up with technologies that would work for them, especially since they simply didn't, they just simply didn't have the money. So that's the founding of the WiderNet Project, looking for inexpensive, high-impact ways to use information technology for education. And, this server with all these DVDs worth of information, I kept sending more DVDs to my friends at the University of Jos, and they were telling other people, and pretty soon other people were asking me for DVDs, and I kept sending them out. And next thing I know, people in Ghana are contacting me saying, can you send us the same DVDs? And that's how the eGranary Digital Library was born. First it was just DVDs, and then it got to be too cumbersome, and we moved to first a whopping 120 gigabyte hard drive. And just started filling it up with information.
But this is all information you're curating. You're downloading this from the web and then putting it on this. So now I've got this hard drive repository.
Right.
Since you can't get out to the big wide, the world wide web, as we used to call it.
Right. So we took a whole website, maybe 25,000 pages. We just copy it all.
Yeah.
Put it on a hard drive and send it there. Since then, we've spiffed it up quite a bit. Now it's like 3,000 websites. We've got the entire Wikipedia, Khan Academy, the TED Talks. We even have the People's Pharmacy.
I don't blame you. That's a good show.
It's a great show.
A lot of information there. What do you do about permissions now? Do you run into those kind of problems, or is that?
Well, I would say about half of the content, especially since the Wikipedia is so huge, is open source, but we've contacted thousands of authors and publishers, and we say, look, 2/3 of the world can't see your website. Can we help distribute? And most of them say yes.
So you get this stuff out there. It's on hard drives. Now we have access to it because we don't need a connection to the web. How do you what's happening? And are you sort of paying attention to what happens once folks have access to this information?
Sure. So when they open up the granary, they're at a home page that has a search engine and a catalog, like a catalog you'd find at a public library here. And a search engine, it's not exactly Google, but we didn't have $30 billion. So it's a search engine. And and they can just start from there, start finding websites, start finding information. We get a lot of the work we do is people telling us what they need. So we get requests from the field, people saying we need more agriculture, we need more veterinary science, we need this, that, the other thing. Our librarians go out and, using our high-speed internet here, find the resources, get the permission, and then make copies for them. But beyond that, beyond just being able to consume, right now I think we've got 35 million documents on this collection. Besides that, we've also built in tools so people can make their own websites and upload their own content. So people are making videos on their phone in local languages and uploading it and sharing it to everybody on their local area network.
Yeah, I like this because, again, the theory behind this is with access to enough raw information, people come up with their own solutions, which gets us around. There has been this critique about NGOs that go in kind of with their way of doing things from the developed world, but don't always listen as closely. I think they're getting better at that. But they have a way of doing things that can upset cultural values and everything else. This allows people, I guess, to work within cultural and historical norms to create solutions to their own problems.
Right, right, exactly. And these are there's a lot of great homegrown solutions out there, and oftentimes, when I first started doing training in a new location, people, I'm saying, you guys got tons of information here that needs to be in your collection. And, what do you mean? I said, well, how about a map of your university or some, list of all the restaurants in town or hospitals and their opening hours and things like that. We get that ball rolling and suddenly it just cascades. And people start realizing, there's a lot of information here and we haven't seen it. Probably one of the more striking experiences is being with a group of people, and, I was in Malawi, and these librarians in Malawi say, ooh, show us something on Malawi. So I go to Wikipedia, and I open up the Malawi page in Wikipedia, and it is a page, right? It's one page, one country, thousands of years worth of culture and tradition reduced to a page. Mm. And it's really disappointing. Yeah. And so I was like, okay, guys, we got to start making Malawi pages.
And they've done that. Tell us about, too, your inspirations all the way through this. You've said that you have been inspired by saints for much of your life that you've met throughout your journey that just do things that need to be done. One of them is Veronica. Tell us about her.
Veronica Agbaye. Yeah. She is the mother of a student of mine. And I only met her about 6 years ago. When I was in their hometown, I was invited over to dinner, her two daughters and son were sitting at the dinner table. We're sitting around talking. Now, I know that her husband had died back in 2000 from AIDS. And so she's been raising this family by herself and working as a high school principal. But as we're sitting around talking at the table, I noticed there's some guys hanging around. And these aren't, they're not waiting on us. They're not preparing food. They're not doing, you know, they're just hanging. They're eating and studying. And, but they're not at the family table. So I'm like, what's with the extra guys? And the two daughters kind of like nod towards mom and go, Mom. And so I'm like, Mom? And mom says, well, you know, they're from the village. And I said, well, that doesn't explain a whole lot. So I get to hear the story. And the story is that these young men, their parents have died of AIDS. And they just show up at her door with a little note from the village saying, can you please help take care of this boy? And Veronica would take them in, take them to the doctor, take them to the dentist, and get them enrolled in school and take care of them until they turned 18. And I looked at Veronica and I said, so how many boys have you done this for? And she says, oh, maybe 10. And the two daughters are like, Mom. And so I looked to one of the daughters and she says, 43.
But who's counting, right?
Yeah, right, but who's counting? Veronica died this last summer from AIDS herself. But here's a person, unheralded, unscripted, unasked. She just did it because it needed to be done. Right. And there are people like that all over the developing world.
You also, another example, I think, is someone named Ron Rice. Tell us about Ron Rice.
Dr. Ron Rice. He's a retired Presbyterian minister from Seattle, Washington. And he wound up at Jos in Nigeria and met one of my students. And Ayuba was exposed to polio when he was young. And so he got around. He had wooden blocks on his hands and his knees, and he got around on his hands and knees. Ron saw this, and he just said, that's appalling. And so here's this retired guy. He says, I'm gonna get this guy a wheelchair. So he did some research to find out what would be an appropriate wheelchair, had a wheelchair made, and gave Ayuba a wheelchair. And Ayuba immediately said to him, there are thousands more just like me. So the two of them struck up a partnership. Ayuba finished his school and went to law school. He's now a state senator. But the two of them built a shop. They hired Christians and Muslims to work side by side. Everybody has one form of disability or another, and they manufacture wheelchairs. They have distributed 14,000 wheelchairs to polio victims in northern Nigeria.
And I'm guessing that the people who produce these are getting paid, too. So, again, it's kind of an economic development project that grows out of the grassroots. Your project, the Granary, sounds like it's also awfully labor-intensive. You've got people involved, and that means a lot of volunteers, right?
We get a lot of volunteers, a lot of students from UNC Chapel Hill. We also have an office near the Research Triangle Park. We get a lot of volunteers from there as well. There's a lot of technology and a lot of labor that goes into it. We also have now, I think, 14 people we call field associates. These are young entrepreneurial people with some technical background and really good communication skills. And in their country, in their community, they promote the idea of this offline library. They do installations. They do training. And some of them make some good money. Jennifer in Nigeria has installed over 150 libraries. And
so then when does she gets paid? Where does that come from?
She gets a commission.
I see, yeah.
On the sale, but most of her money comes from the recipient, the person who's purchasing this. They pay her to do the training.
Yeah.
And they pay her to come back and continue to do more training, and they wind up being a customer. Once they have the granary, they want to have more computers, and then it'll just.
And it's not free, and you did that for a reason, to make it entirely free.
No, if you give things away, they'll just, you know, languish in somebody's bottom drawer. And this stuff is expensive. If somebody calls me and says, "Hey, we can't afford $2,000 for a library," I agree with them, right? Because the computers and the networking and the staffing are all going to cost 10 times as much as that. So if people aren't ready, they haven't already figured out that this stuff is expensive, then they're probably not ready for a library.
Yeah. Volunteers, you have one fairly well-known who had developed his own reputation before he came to you as a volunteer who's in this area, right?
That's right, yeah. William Kamkwamba from Malawi. He became famous on the TED stage wound up writing a book called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. And when he was 15 and his parents couldn't pay for him to go to school, he went to one of the very rare local libraries in Malawi, found an article on how to make a windmill and built a windmill. Now his neighbors thought that he was like, Noah building an ark.
Right.
And once he had the electricity, once he was generating electricity, they thought there was some kind of black magic involved. Mm. But he changed a lot of people's minds. And he bridged what we call the no-do gap. He found out about something, he read about it, and then he went and did it. And that's a really hard thing to overcome, to make that bridge. So he's now working at the WiderNet project. He's building modules into the e-granary where people can learn how to drill a well, make a windmill, make a website, whatever. All the materials are available for them to know it. But then to get certified, they have to do it.
Uh-huh.
And he provides them with examples of things they could do to get their certificate.
And you have this in American prisons as well.
We do.
Tell us about that and the value of that.
Well, this is a funny thing because one of the things I do on the side is I like to play drums. And for 15 years, I led a drum circle at a prison in Iowa. And for 10 of those 15 years, we met in the evening in the library and played drums. And it took 10 years for it to sink into my head. These guys need an offline library as much as anybody mm-hmm. else. So we started with that, and now we're in 20 prisons around the U.S. These are, people who are in prison, they can't be on the internet by law in most places, and they could create a lot of havoc if they were on the internet. Mm-hmm. So there's good reason to keep them off the internet. On the other hand, most of them are going to wind up being back in society.
Right.
And they need to understand this technology. They need to know how to work with information. They need to be able to make that call between fake news and real news, right? And so they need as much as anybody else to master this technology.
And so right now you've got about 3 million people, you think, using this?
Yeah, yeah.
All told?
It's
growing.
Yeah, 1,600 locations have installed it so far. And some of those are, universities with 25,000 students.
Great stuff, Cliff. What a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank.
Cliff Misson is a professor in the School of Information and Library Science at UNC Chapel Hill, and you can find out more about his WiderNet project at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.